You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride, and thank you for being here with us today as we celebrate a Juno writer who was named the Rasmussen Foundation's Distinguished Artist of the Year. Ernestine Hayes, a professor best known for her books Blonde Indian and Tao of Raven. She was honored on Friday in a virtual ceremony that began with words from Hune Lance Twitchell, one of her colleagues at the University of Alaska Southeast.
Ernestine Hayes, wasa achtu yake yidlaki ya yaki. Connahoi exahan. Ya at she aya. At kautushi hetra ach yeti. Achshuqua yeti. Scoot atach aya we at she. My name is Hune, and I'm coming to you from the land of the Occoquan people here in Juneau, Alaska. I'm so happy for you, Ernestine Hayes. You're a writer of incredible power and importance. There's no one who's more deserving of a recognition for being one of the state's finest artists. I had the honor of working with you, trying to start little revolutions, trying to keep big revolutions going. You're a constant source of inspiration, and I'd like to share this song with you.
And that song, Hune Lance Twitchell says, has words about throwing your troubles into the water and emerging from the icy waters reborn.
Way-yo, hey-yo, way-yo, hi-na. Way-yo, hey-yo, way-yo, hi-na. Way-yo, hi-na. Way-yo, hey-yo.
Adam Gibbons, a Rasmussen board member, thanked Hayes for having the courage to share what has been a painful life's journey, from the challenges of discrimination as a child to surviving homelessness.
You are a living, breathing, storytelling treasure, an author, a poet, a professor, a little blonde granddaughter, and a grandmother. Your storytelling talent is a treasure.
I have recently faced that my journey of marginalization began in my earliest years. The little girl I write about was excluded from both cultures in territorial Alaska. I had one friend in whose home I was welcome. Her name was Willa. This life pattern continued throughout my childhood, throughout my years in California, and throughout my life after I returned. I came to accept exclusion as a feature of my life path. However, this generosity, this recognition, this acceptance, this honor overwhelms me and has taught me that I am part of a community that embraces me. You have given me a gift that fulfills the deep need I've lived with since I was that marginalized little girl. I feel your acceptance. I feel accepted. Gunarchish. Gunarchish.
And Gunarchish, Ernestine Hayes, for being with us today to tell us a little more about this extraordinary recognition that you've received. And of course, it's one of many because you've also been a writer laureate, among other things. But I know that you were pretty overwhelmed and pretty much just cried through the whole ceremony. How are you feeling now?
I was feeling pretty good until you played that, and now I'm crying again.
Well, I hope they are tears of joy, because this is very joyful. You know, maybe for starters, you could just tell us a little bit about your life for those of us who may not have been able to read your books, but tell us about your journey and how it came to be a part of your writing.
Well, I was born in Territorial Alaska at the end of the Second World War. And when I was 15, my mother and I moved to California. And I stayed there for 25 long years, and I never came home. And finally, when I turned 40, my sons were either living with their father or grown. And I decided to come home no matter what. It took me 8 months to get from San Francisco to Ketchikan, and I lived in my car, stood in food lines, slept in shelters, camped out in Ketchikan, and finally made it home after 2 years. And I came to believe that that journey of leaving and coming back, of distance and return, was one of the primary themes of my life, and that structured my first book.
You know, you've got some excerpts from your books to read to us, and so we would just love to have you share some passages with us. Why don't you start with Blonde Indian? So that was your first book.
Yes, I'll be happy to. I chose this first one because I wanted to emphasize that I was marginalized and excluded right from the beginning of when I was sent out into the world as a kindergarten student. But before that, I didn't realize my position like every child. I just thought the world that I lived in was normal. My mother was diagnosed with tuberculosis not long after I was born. For the first few years, she was an intermittent patient at the public health hospital across the creek from our old house. Every few days, my grandmother walked me through a field of wildflowers and dewdrops to a window in my mother's quarantined world. My mother and her companions, other tubercular native women and their nurses, wore white half masks tied to their faces. They peeked through the window and laughed, their faces framing my mother's hidden smile. Above the masks, their eyes squinted laughter. Beneath the masks, their smiles sparkled through the cotton as they waved. I played in the light rain around the corner from the shady morning side of the building while my grandmother and mother talked. When it was time to go, I said goodbye and watched my mother act out the mask-covered words. I love you. And I waved and smiled back before we left. When you're picking berries, grandmother said, always make noise. That way the bear will go away before you see him. She went about her chores, guiding clothes through the wringer washer, stirring stews of fish or deer meat bubbling on the stove. She showed me how to pick out delicate parts of the fish head, how to peel half-formed salmon berry shoots for a tender new taste of green, how to talk to my cousin, the brown bear. If he comes up to you, don't run. Talk to him. Remind him that you're his cousin. Tell him you only want enough berries for you and your family. Tell him you only want your share. Brown bears and people have often intermarried, hence we are cousins. We must never eat brown bear meat. For us, it would be like eating a person. We must always show respect even when we kill them. Other things should never be killed at all. You should never kill spiders. They're good luck. They protect you. They tell you secrets, she instructed. Never kill a spider. It's lucky when they live in your house. Bears were my cousin, and the wind was my grandfather. I had no sisters or brothers, and I had few friends. But wild plants grew on the hill beside our old house, and a creek led up the mountains behind me, and seaweed and crabs danced in the ocean channel at my feet. I never questioned that I belonged.
And yet, while you felt you belonged in nature, it sounds like it was harder to feel belonged or feel that like you belonged in your own native community as well as in the non-native community.
And I think that's true. Now, I didn't know my father. My mother wasn't married. She was gone to the hospital a lot. My grandparents drank. We were poor. I was often dressed in dirty clothes and hungry. And even when my mother came back, I was undisciplined. I ran wild. I was a little girl that it was not, it's not difficult to understand why other parents during the 1950s didn't really want their children to be too close to me.
Today, with the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, we're hearing more about a lot of the issues that you've raised for a long time, that feeling of being isolated, being treated as the other. Does some of what's going on today in our social scene resonate with you?
Well, without doubt, because we can see that all the institutions that have been placed upon us to oppress us are designed to produce our failure, to produce our isolation, to produce our feelings of inadequacy, because that's what the institutions are meant to do. Even Native education was designed to produce Native failure, and of course it's successful at what it was designed to do, as are all the institutions, the Western institutions that are based on colonization, are designed to produce the way we feel, the marginalization, the trauma, the grief, the pain. That's what they're meant to do. And understanding that and realizing it and recognizing it is the first huge step. And I think that's where we're at.
Well, through your stories, people say they come to a lot of realizations, especially about how painful some of the things were that people endured. I was just curious as I was reading you, hearing you describe the masks and your mom being isolated because of TB. Does the pandemic bring back feelings of the past for you?
I think that it maybe sees it from a different perspective. I was moved in by that same thought that here we are wearing masks again, and maybe this is a time for a transformation in a good direction. Maybe when we take our masks off this time, it will be to face a better truth.
And so you've got one more passage to read for us from your second book, so I'd love to hear that.
I chose one from Dow of Raven, which I think which shows what happens after we start going to school. We feel included and loved and embraced and part of nature when we're very, very young and still home. But when we're sent into school and Western-based education does its work on us, it doesn't take long for us to feel marginalized. This comes from a day when I was about 12 years old, and I was running around on a summer day, and my mother had given me her Kodak camera to use, and I ran into some white children from school, and we weren't friends, but we recognized each other, and we all went over to the dock and started fishing right off the dock outside cold storage, and one of the boys pointed down south on the dock and said, "Look at that drunk Indian coming our way." And it was my grandfather. Everyone tried to be quiet as my grandfather walked toward us. The other children, their derision ill-concealed by poor attempts to cover their snorts of laughter, took hesitant steps backward as my grandfather neared. Finally, we all stood too close to one another, within the distance of a man's height, his reach, his life, the white children I dared to imagine as my friends, staging their retreat behind me, ready to dash for the safety of another world, my grandfather in front of me offering a whiskered smile, saluting me with the heavy flatfish he proudly held up for my regard and admiration. I at the torn seam of two worlds, dreams faded like dappling sunlight, the only choice, no choice at all, to embrace the life that had been designed for me, no less than the lives that had been designed by these children's parents for us all, to give back the proud smile my grandfather offered, to know that despite the fish slime, despite the days-old whiskers, despite the headache and lost fingers and sharp grief, here was a man who understood what it meant to be proud. I took his picture and gave him a hug. I admired the salt fresh fish. We both knew he would sell it to some lucky cook and would use the money to buy more wine. We both knew it would take far more than a sunny afternoon for me to make friends of those softened pink children. We both knew that those children's fathers, though they ran the town and ran the schools and ran the courts and ran our lives, would never possess the courage that my grandfather showed every day by simply waking up and going on. We both knew that even though halibut cheeks were my mother's favorite summer meal, and even though there was no chance that we might fry one up tonight, my grandfather loved me as much as any grandfather had ever loved his wild, unreliable, unpredictable grandchild. The next time I saw those children, as we passed each other in the halls of the school designed to exalt them, we didn't speak.
What did it take to pull that out of yourself?
I have to sit at the keyboard and silence myself and allow all those feelings and all those images and all those sensory impressions just to envelop and surround me. And when I face them and confront them, it actually makes me feel stronger.
Did it take you a while in life to put it all together, to realize that it was kind of your life's work to put all these conflicting pieces together? An alcoholic grandfather who you loved and loved you, but maybe you didn't love his behavior?
It took me quite a while to realize even that I had a story to tell. And once I began writing my story and putting it together and fashioning it into a book-length work that also included my story, but the story of old Tom and young Tom and the bear and the seasons and the fish, I realized that I wasn't just telling my story. I was telling the story of all the Native people in colonized 20th century Alaska, and those of us who lived through the 20th century and are here now are walking wounded in a cultural war, and we are survivors.
Well, when you put it in that context, it becomes a totally different thing, doesn't it? I mean, to walking wounded. And we never stop to think of that, I think, in our day-to-day lives as to how things got to be the way they are. So can I ask, Ernestine, how old are you?
I will be 76 in a little over a month. I was born in 1945.
So when did you start writing?
Well, I always thought of myself as a writer, and I always wrote at things, but I didn't really become a serious writer until I enrolled at the University of Alaska Southeast at the age of 50, and I learned that writing takes a lot of discipline.
And so you're not afraid to start new things, no matter how old you are. What an inspiration that is. So at 76, what are your plans? What are you working on now?
Well, we're hoping to move into the house that burned 3 years ago. I have a really great contractor now, Specialty Renovations. Jay has promised that July will be our move-in date, and I want to set up my computer and find any old notes and books that may have survived the fire and storage and the water damage, and begin working on my third book in what I hope will be an Alaska Native trilogy.
Wow. I can't wait to see what comes out of that. And I know that when you were recognized on Friday, that was one of the first things you mentioned is the fire. And of course, this recognition comes with a very hefty stipend, a remarkable stipend. And I could see you were just overwhelmed by that.
Absolutely. It couldn't have come at a better time, because one of the things that had to be done is when I retired, I had to access my whole retirement fund and use it to conduct the repairs on this house, because the negotiations with the insurance company have just lagged for so long. I couldn't wait any longer, so I used pretty much all my retirement. And of course, I owe a lot of taxes on that. And so this is just so perfectly timed. Now I'm meeting the taxes, the storage, the hauling, the refurnishing. It's all going to happen now, and I'm just overjoyed as well as overwhelmed.
Well, your life has been full of these twists and turns, and I remember the scene in Fiddler on the Roof when Tevye, the kind of the patriarch of the family, turns to God, looks up at the sky and says, well, I understand, you know, we are the chosen ones, but why are you always choosing us? Do you sometimes wonder, like, why me, that all these things, a mom with tuberculosis, you know, raised among alcoholics who loved you, but still posed many challenges, a house fire. Do you just sometimes say, why me?
I have learned not to question my path, but I really have also learned not to actually not trust some of my reactions to the challenges on my path. I think I could have made it easier, but I believe that anybody who comes onto my path is either Buddha trying to teach me or Raven trying to trick me.
I guess it's like a two-sided coin, isn't it? So what's your basic philosophy of life in a nutshell?
I've been looking back at my age. I've been looking back at all the patterns and repeating lessons that have come up in my life. And I think just trusting my path is what I'm trying to do now.
Well, you said something earlier when we were talking before we went on the air, that you try to always keep one foot in the future. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I look in the future when I'm trying to make a decision. I look and put myself like 5 years in the future, and I look back and say, what will I be glad I did or sorry I didn't do? And I remind myself that as old as I am and as old as I feel, this, I will never be as young as I am today. I will never again be this young. And so I just try to motivate myself by reminding myself of that truth.
So you're looking out 5 years from now. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing myself in this house next door that was built in 1906, but is essentially a new house with new wiring, new plumbing and insulation. And my granddaughter is going to be the woman of the house, and I'm going to hand all those daily cares to her because she's more than able to do that. And I'll be writing.
And just before we go, One of the things you mentioned during the ceremony is how proud you are of young people, that they are embracing their culture and language.
Yes, absolutely. Young people will lead us into the future. Young people know what kind of world has been created for them. Young people have a really solid understanding of the brink that we're standing at. And I believe young people are our leaders of today. And I believe that young people will help us decolonize, smash the patriarchy, undo capitalism, and resist.
And how do you feel about how much pride they take in their culture and their and a large number of children who are learning Tlingit?
Absolutely. And Lance Twitchell, I put all the work that he's done, and his charisma and his talent and his intelligence has inspired so many children and young people of college and high school age to learn the language. And I really agree with him that that is the basis, the foundation for our future.
Don't you kind of wish that you were born now to experience all of the things that kids are exposed to today?
I would love to be born now, but it would have to be, you know, I don't know if I'd want to be young again because I was such a foolish girl.
But such a wise woman. So I guess the foolishness was necessary to teach you how to be wise, maybe.
I guess that was on my path.
Well, I enjoyed hearing about your path so much today. Thank you for being with us and giving us your time. I know you're much in demand today with all the accolades. So thanks for being with us.
Thanks for the invitation. Gunash Chish.
Gunash Chish. And we're going to end with more of Lance Twitchell's song for you.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.